Welcome to Lead Follow, a podcast for pastors and leaders, hosted by MCUSA Executive Director Glenn Guyton. Join Glenn as he talks to folks across the denomination to help equip today's leaders who are leading while following Jesus.
Hello, I'm Glenn Guyton, and during this season of Lead Follow, we'll be exploring ways to reimagine church. Today, I'm pleased to welcome the Reverend Dr. Jacob Allen Cook, who will be discussing reimagining ministerial formation. Now, Jacob is an assistant professor of Christian ethics at Eastern Mennonite Seminary and the academic program director for its Pathways for Tomorrow grant from the Lilly Endowment Incorporated Foundation. The Pathways initiative was conceived to help theological schools better understand and meet the needs of congregations and their leaders. Welcome, Jacob. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you, Glenn?
Good. Now you go by Jake?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, you go by Jake.
My friends call me Jake.
Jake, like State Farm?
I reject that association. In fact, I was really reluctant to wear my khaki pants today.
Oh, okay. You could have red shirt. You
yeah, that's right.
It would have been perfect.
I know. Yeah.
All right. Well, now I know that you come from a different background. You're not Mennonite. You come from the Cooperative Baptist.
That's right.
I'll tell you, well, since we're talking about Baptists, when I first joined the Mennonites, I thought they were anti-Baptist,
but you're with
anti-Baptist. But you're with the Cooperative Baptist.
That's right.
Yeah. So we're good
that's
on the
right.
Baptist.
Yep. Baptist. We're cooperating.
All right. We're cooperating. But so as you think about, let's think about the program that you are responsible for and how we develop pastors and leaders in the church. So if we're going to reimagine that, reimagining an organization involves transforming how it operates, thinks, and achieves its goals. It's about taking a fresh, innovative approach to every aspect of the organization to enhance its efficiency, adaptability, and overall success. So as you think about how churches develop leaders and pastors, what is one thing that you would reimagine about that and why?
Ooh, we're starting with the softball.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, over the last couple of years as I've learned to navigate the Mennonite Church USA world, I think I found more things that are working well than things that I would start by reimagining. So okay. If I could say that first, I would feel a lot more comfortable saying the other part, glow and grow.
Okay.
So I think, you know, I went to my first MennoCon last summer.
Oh, okay.
I've met with the gathered body of conference ministers mm-hmm. and learned from their collective wisdom. I've seen a lot of local churches. And I find that in each of these spaces, I've been welcomed. I have found intellectual rigor and spiritual earnestness. Mm-hmm. I found folks trying to follow Jesus. And that, to me, that's very encouraging.
Okay.
If I were to say something about reimagining, I would say, let's embrace the reimagining process.
Okay.
So this is about MCUSA, but it's also about local institutions as well. I wonder how we can kind of put on the shelf for a little while the mentality that first responds by saying, well, that would be a departure from the way we typically do things
right here.
You know, the honoring of the past that sometimes gets in the way of the future.
Okay.
So in my field of ethics, when you think about how people put together a way of thinking about or a picture for the world, we tend to focus on one piece of the biblical story. Let's say somebody wants to return to the original creational way that God meant for us to live in the world. Or maybe somebody's going to focus especially on the legal framework that carried the people forward in a time after the fall, or Jesus' reimagining of that. And I think for me, theologically, I tend to get my guidance out of the future.
Okay.
Which is a little harder to get your hands around. You know, you can't always understand it. You can't hold on to it. But it has a gravity of its own that draws us forward. And so I think that really our call is to always be oriented to this possible future, to the future fullness of whatever it is that God is bringing into this world. Yeah. And so I think if I were to say, let's do something, let's reimagine something, I'd say let's first just embrace that.
Embrace it.
Yeah. That reimagining is a piece of what we do as a people.
All right. Well, I have a background in strategic foresight. It's one of the things I'm really interested in. Yeah. And also how the trends that we experience as human beings and people, how that will, you know, from the past, how will that inform our future? And so I'm really excited about the things that you're doing in this future focus or thinking about tomorrow as we look at the church. But I, you know, why is it so difficult for people to embrace this reimagining process? Like, what are we afraid of?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly what are we afraid of, and I think it's partly what have we fallen in love with.
Ooh,
you know,
ooh,
it's okay. Both
that's
things,
a nice way
right?
to say it.
Yeah.
That's a nice way to say it.
Yeah, I think that we have really great things that we have become practiced at. We have a history that we cherish.
Yeah.
It's part of our theological tradition, part of our way of being church in this place and in, you know, at large.
Okay.
So I think that there's a lot to love, and it feels like loss to begin reimagining because you're suggesting that what we have isn't already great.
Right, right.
And so I think that part of the shift that needs to happen is to say, what we have is great, and there is more and other and different that can also be good and add to and enhance rather than taking away.
Yeah.
It's not to say that there isn't loss. And I think we face challenges.
Right.
As a school, as a church, we face challenges. But I think for me, it's more we become attached and we become comfortable.
Right.
And we embrace what we have and moving forward.
We continue to get drawn to those things that we love, like from the past, what we're used to.
Yeah.
It's kind of like my experience with gas station pizza. Like I have this love for gas station pizza. I don't know where
it
comes from. But I know that at this age.
There's a great one right over there.
At this age, I need to move away from that, eat more salads, right? I need to eat something that's a little bit better that's going to take me to the future. So that's kind of my personal struggle.
I appreciate that, yeah.
But at Eastern Mennonite Seminary, you are focused on equipping future pastors and leaders to deal with the challenges that we have today. So what are some of the key focus areas of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think at first it helps to imagine what are those challenges. And before I even arrived at Eastern Mennonite Seminary, they used a phase one grant for this Pathways project to do some research and figure out from our alums and current students and key focus groups of pastors and others who have an interest in what we're doing. What are the challenges you see? Mm-hmm. What kinds of things do you think we've done well? Mm-hmm. And how would you like to see us forming folks differently for the work of ministering in the world and in the church? And what we discovered is folks are quite anxious, understandably so, about the polarization in our society amid varieties, vast quantities of injustice. So those things are a piece of the puzzle that we have to ask. How do we help form folks well to address, to withstand, to do something different than letting the kind of polarization of the wider world backflow into the life of the church, mm-hmm. which we see happening, right? And another key challenge that I think we face, and this is at the denominational level, and it's also at the local level, is the declining numbers of folks who are engaged in the mission that we have. Mm-hmm. So that means a number of things, including now, there are fewer churches that are supporting full-time pastors, and what does it mean to contribute meaningfully as a school to the formation of folks who, you know, haven't and won't be able to engage in a three-year MDiv program, you know, that's been kind of a historical standard for folks who are stepping into pastoral ministry. So what do we do to form more people mm-hmm. with some aspect of what we do in ways that will help the church?
And so what do we do?
Yeah, that's right. And so
what
that's
do we do?
That's the key question.
Yeah.
And to address the problems, the areas that we've really wanted to focus on as growth areas are kind of situated in what it means to be a part of the life of Eastern Mennonite University. So we're embedded in a larger university that has other programs,
right.
which is somewhat unique. Mm-hmm. Not all seminaries are like that. And for us, we have right next door the Center for Justice and Peace Building
that
has, you know, for 27 years or so, focused on conflict transformation work in real, embodied, practical ways. And so there's a lot of skill and a lot of learning around conflict transformation, the best of restorative practices, how to understand and address trauma and its impacts and to become more resilient leaders. Mm-hmm. And so in the face of polarization, we're asking, how can we help people in churches, pastors and other leaders, become the kind of people who can alleviate tension rather than heighten the sense of polarization, right?
Yeah.
How do we form for that? And And then, you know, thinking about also at the same time, the like decreasing number of folks who can be full-time engaged in learning. How do we make learning more accessible to more people? So to do that, at least in the curricular area, one thing that we've done is we've built a number of collaborative programs with the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, so you can study with both of us at the same time.
Okay.
And we've made those relatively short. Mm-hmm. So there's a 6-course certificate in faith-based peacebuilding.
Okay.
And if you engage in that and really like it by the time you get done, you can actually leverage that into any of the master's degrees that would build on more credit hours, further study. This year, we've also launched a 36-hour Master of Arts in Theological Studies that can focus in peacebuilding. And you would take a third of your credits through the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that all of our courses are hybrid, online, accessible, right? For folks who are living anywhere. You don't have to come be residential. You don't have to dedicate 3 to 7 years of study to finish something, right? You can do this in 1 or 2 years and feel like you have received some valuable formation for the work that you're about. And then, you know, we have that it's all scalable, right? So we also have, coming down the pike, a Doctor of Ministry degree in peacemaking and social change. So for those who are actually asking from a professional position, how can I receive the deepest level of formation for the work of conflict transformation? We're working on that end of development as well.
And so is that where you see the growing need in congregations is just this conflict transformation? Is that what pastors are going to be focused on now?
I think they wish they had those skills.
Okay.
You know, I think many folks make it through seminary and have taken maybe a leadership course. Mm-hmm. And many of those leadership courses are centered around kind of a theory of leadership, more so than the practices of leadership. And so somewhere between the work of conflict transformation and peace and justice work and the world of adaptive leadership and collaborative leadership formation, I think there are skill sets that cross those two areas. And in fact, when I do conflict transformation training myself, I feel like the best time to do that is before the heat's up, right?
Yeah, in times
of peace,
relative
peace. And the way that I go about doing that tends to be actually with the skill set of adaptive leadership, from the adaptive leadership world. And that's because they're already thinking about, you know, the adaptive means the kind of problems that show up because people are people, and they're shifting. It's a shifting landscape because of how people interact with the problem and with each other in the problem. So I think that if we can do this work where we're focused on leadership formation with real skills focused and not just theory of what leadership could be, servant leadership or something, and the work of conflict transformation, which gets us into really the heart of what's going on, what's driving people.
Right.
Amid anxiety and challenging times, we'll find a sweet spot that really enables pastors to do the work well.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask you this question. I talked to David Brubaker during this season, so hopefully this will have already aired by the time your episode comes.
All right,
so, but just talked to him about the polarization and conflicts that many congregations have, and there are a couple of types of leaders that I see emerge in those settings, and maybe you can say, what kind of leaders have you seen emerge in those types of polarized contexts?
Yeah, I feel like I've talked to so many pastors across the country in various denominations who are facing challenges with churches that are quite mixed ideologically. Mm-hmm. And their question is, How do I engage in meaningful work when this is the setup?
Right.
You know, if I say anything that edges one way, I'm going to upset this subset of members, and the same likewise in the other. And so I would say that the tendency is, I mean, there are like 5 different conflict styles that are easily identifiable, but like the tendency is to either go all the way to, it's going to be my way, and I'm going to stand on my territory, on my beliefs.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, then either you can get organized and get me out,
hit the road,
or you can go. Or you see the exact opposite, which is complete avoidance of the issues.
Okay.
What I love about Dave's work is that, you know, he talks about having a sense of courage and clarity around what it is that you believe.
Yes.
While also having compassion for those who don't hold that same position. And for him, you know, and I fully believe this, we need leaders who can be clear, communicate well what it is that they believe, while not shutting down the conversation with those who might not hold the same perspective.
All right.
We have to model that kind of, like, that kind of polarization disabling leadership, right?
I think we need more of that, and I hope people are paying attention to that, and I'm glad that you all shared similar thoughts on that. But we get this authoritarian leader sometimes that emerges. I call them jerks. That's what I call them. That's not David. That's me.
Just that's just everyday.
Jerks. They're just jerks. Or you get those leaders that don't want to take a stand.
That's right.
And I call them wet noodles. You don't want wet noodle leaders either, right? Because leaders are supposed to lead, right? Pastor. If you think about what the word means, right? You're a pastor, a shepherd. You're guiding people, and it just really bothers me when people that are placed in leadership roles say, oh, I don't have an opinion about this. Oh, I'm going to stay neutral. Yeah. You're not a leader. What are you?
And you might not actually be honest, right? You're not showing up as you.
Yeah.
You're maybe doing what you think the role requires of you.
Right.
Which is, I think, one of the shames of moving toward a model as church. This isn't on MCUSA. Mm-hmm. This is like across the board in the U.S., it seems. That churches have abdicated all leadership, like the people, and they want the pastors to be the leaders until now. Right? Now, when pastors attempt to lead on moral issues, that's when folks get upset, so they want them to do the everyday work and all of it, right? They want the pastor to be the only one who goes to hospitals to do visitations,
right.
They want them to deliver the sermons that are based on the Bible and all of those things, right?
Yes.
But when it comes to saying things about ethics, somehow that's not in the purview of a
pastor. Be quiet, pastor.
Be
quiet, pastor. We don't want to hear what you have to think. Now, I do think, though, that there are some cultural differences, different traditions where pastors are a little bit more seen as the final word, right? Mm-hmm. They are it. You know, you listen to the pastor, do what the pastor says. That's not the typical Mennonite way. But so I think we can take it too far in some other traditions. There are some cultural biases that come into play when we think about these things. But if, you know, thinking about this Anabaptist Mennonite context, how do we equip pastors? Like, what does, from the congregational point of view? Now, I know what you all are doing, education and those types of things. But then if I'm, you know, the person in the pew, because, you know, there's my old pastor used to say, someone's always in charge. It may not be the pastor, but someone's always in charge. It may be Brother Sam that's sitting in the back pew that has a lot of money, and he kind of controls how things work. So how can congregations help pastors succeed and serve the community?
I think for me, maybe I'll refer to the Confession of Faith here.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So I read it, and I know that when talking about ministry and leadership, mm-hmm. and this is true in the Baptist tradition too, right? We focus on the priesthood of all believers.
Yes.
That's where we start. Yeah. And then we ask questions about what's different about someone who's called to be a pastoral leader and paid to do that kind of work.
Right.
But starting with the idea that everyone in the church is called to be a minister and has some role in the work of the church, I think one of the best things that folks in churches can do is actually do a fair amount of learning and growing themselves.
Okay, all right.
So I've said ever since I graduated from seminary some number of years ago that everyone should go to seminary.
Oh, wow.
Everyone should engage in some seminary learning.
And I think everyone in the Mennonite church has.
It seems to me true, right? I show up and folks are informed. They are, that's right. I mean, you go to any church in this area and there are tons of current and past pastors, folks who are ministering in other contexts. Yeah, absolutely, it's true. And in the adaptive leadership world, you know, the basic wisdom or insight is anyone can lead anywhere, anytime. It's about influence. And so the question for me becomes, like, can you imagine, just imagine, a church in which the lay leadership team actually engages in formation around leadership practices,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
and takes up a common language for that kind of work and can remind each other when the heat starts to rise, this is how we handle this.
Yeah.
Right? We know how to get on the balcony and look down on the dance floor. We can get in that meta space, right?
Yeah,
and look down.
Right.
And imagine being the pastor of a congregation that already knows how to do that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, on the one hand, you could imagine the authoritarian pastor feeling a bit threatened by a really strong lay leadership.
Right, right.
But I would sure love that kind of collaboration as a pastor.
Yeah.
To know that your people are care, they're informed, they've worked hard at it. And I think that that's part of our responsibility too.
Yeah.
I mean, a key piece of the programming that we've been building under this grant program is not curricular. It's not about getting graduate credit.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually about how do we take what we're doing and bring it on the road
yeah.
so that folks in churches and can, by way of access and regional conferences, right? How can we open access to this kind of learning to more people? So like, you know, to show up at a regional conference and then work with the folks who are in lay leadership and board chairs to develop these skills and to feel confident, like, we could at least read this book together, y'all, and see if some of this language stands out to us, right?
Yeah.
To take up those practices.
And I'm surprised you said you read the Confession of Faith, because I know a lot of people talk about the Confession of Faith, but they've never actually read it.
It's true.
They read, like, well, we're going to read just one section. We haven't read the whole thing.
I know which section it was,
too. Yeah, I read the whole thing. It was a section on foot washing, though. That's
right.
I tell people, hey, did you read the section on foot washing? No, I appreciate that. One of the books that I give my teams when I lead teams is, you wouldn't guess what book it is. It's a book I select for my teams to read. What would you think?
I don't know. I mean, the Sunday school answer is the Bible, but you're going to say something in the adaptive leadership world, I hope.
Well, it's just The Little Red Hen.
Okay.
The Little Red Hen, because, you know, everyone had to pitch in. The Little Red Hen encouraged everyone to pitch in. You know, hey, can you help me grind the wheat? Can you help me, you know, get this? Can you help me bake the bread? And everybody's like, no, not I. Mm-hmm. But then at the end, you know, everyone wanted to partake of the end results,
absolutely,
right? But they didn't want to do the hard work. Yes. And I kind of hear you saying that that the church, as you support your leaders, need to do some of the hard work, whether it's studying, being engaged in what's going on, being a part of the solution for this leadership process that is not just the pastor, but everyone has a role, right?
That's right.
Yeah, everyone isn't called to preach. Everyone can't make every decision, but you can be a part of that process.
Yeah, and I mean, it makes me think of two things. One is the old wisdom that people support what they help build.
Ooh, I like that, yeah.
Right, which I think is like a pithy way of saying the hen thing, right? Like,
yeah, right.
They wanted to partake because they had a part in the process.
Yep.
And the second thing just went right out the window.
That's okay.
It
happens to all of us, though.
It was very smart.
Because the little red hen is such a good analogy. I know it throws us all. But yeah, no, I think it is important that that we are engaged in the process, and I think that's the trouble with this authoritarian leader.
That's right.
People have to have buy-in. People have to be able to kind of touch and be a part of that process, because they are owners of it. That's why I always tell people I'm not the mental pope, right? No, you're not gonna blame me for all of this.
I was looking for your hat.
Yeah. So you're not gonna blame me for all of this. Because if Glenn ran Mennonite Church USA the way Glenn wanted to run Mennonite Church USA, there would be a whole lot of changes.
That's right.
But that's not my role. My role is to help facilitate, you know, what God is doing, and to help and encourage these different regions, these different congregations that are leading and meeting the needs in their context, which I'm not fully aware of. And I couldn't do it.
That's right. Well, you'd have to show up and hang out for a while.
I'd have to be everywhere, right?
Yeah.
My wife would say, hey, where are you? She says it already, but she would say it even more.
The second thing came back in the window.
Okay,
while you were
all
talking.
Right, here we go.
You primed me.
All right.
So I think the other piece of this, right, is that thinking about how leadership does work in a context where there is no authoritarian leader.
Yeah.
This is consistent with who we are as a nonviolent people, right?
Okay.
When we're seeking even influence, it can't be in a coercive way.
Right.
It's not just so that my voice is absolutely heard and I get my way. It's meant to be an exercise of influence, but not undue influence.
Okay.
And so we invite participation.
Yeah.
And also, sometimes you can be really comfortable, and like rightly so, with the folks who are appointed to be a part of this process over here, so doing the work.
Right.
Because if you're regularly in a collaborative relationship with these folks, then like there's trust and a sense of mutuality, and not a fear that if I don't say something right now, my voice will never be heard this issue.
Yeah, you know? That anxiousness.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think you mentioned trust. I have a book that I just wrote. It's a short book about building trust, like 52 tips of how you build harmonious trust in organizations. Yeah. But I think it's important because that trust leads to a less anxious presence. I believe that trust allows people to share and contribute their gifts freely. In other ways, they wouldn't. You know, they would just shut down and they would just, well, they're going to do everything. They have all answers. They don't trust me, so I'm going to let them handle it. And I think that we need to move away from that in the church. And I think even as I understand how Anabaptists work, right, it's not just about this one person that hears from God and has all the answers, but it's about this priesthood of believers, and we all come together and make decisions and share.
That's right.
Yeah. So how can people, well, I know you've talked to conference leaders, but how can congregations tap into what you're offering?
Yeah, I mean, I've sensed a number of fruitful connections. We've made some great connections already. You know, whether that's actually actively working with churches to bring learning possibilities to them. You know, I've been a part of church retreats, leadership retreats over weekends, mm-hmm. With folks who want to do this kind of work. I mean, I would say if somebody from a local church is listening and wants to know how can we get engaged, ask.
Okay.
Like, reach out. Because this is exactly what this grant is enabling us to do, the thing that I'm directing and also the programs that we're building. We intend to work with as many local... I think this is the way of the future, right? Where sort of like the original study here, you ask questions, mm-hmm. right? What could you imagine, what kind of learning could you imagine would be helpful for you in your context? And then we, as folks who do education on a regular basis, right? Like that's what we're thinking about, we're researching and trying to teach. We say, okay, how can we help bridge the gap between what this church wants to learn and what we may have access to, right?
Right.
So in the future, I think, our best areas of growth. The way to become a sustainable learning community is to grow the body, of folks who want to be learning. And to do that, we have to be maximally accessible.
Okay.
So the way to get engaged is to, let's get started.
All right, get started. Ask questions.
That's right.
Be curious.
That's right.
Any final point you want to make or share with the people that are watching us today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would just say talking with you has me very energized.
Okay,
I think
right.
I'm excited about what's happening in MCUSA. I'm excited about the potential. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the things about fixing on the future as your source of, you know, kind of guidance is you can be maximally positive. If you believe that God's future is a pretty fantastic one, then it's pretty easy to get excited about the possibility of moving forward together.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. We definitely want to be excited about the future and keeping our focus on what can be. I always say that this is God's church, and I trust God. You know, I trust God that God is not going to let His church fail. So if you want to keep up with the latest that is happening in Mennonite Church USA, I would encourage you to subscribe to Piecemeal. Piecemeal is our weekly email newsletter, and you can subscribe at MennoniteUSA.org/piecemeal. That's MennoniteUSA.org/piecemeal. Also, your financial support matters. So please consider supporting the ongoing ministry work of Mennonite Church USA at MennoniteUSA.org/give. Thank you so much for joining us today.